From NPR and WBUR, I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. It's Here and Now. And Boeing now says there is a second software problem on its 737 MAX plane. The new issue is not related to the anti-stall software that has now been involved in two fatal crashes, the one in Ethiopia last month, the other one off Indonesia last year. Boeing says it's now working on a fix for both software issues to be completed in the coming weeks. But today's news is raising even more questions about the safety of the 737 MAX. And joining us now is Congressman Peter DeFazio, who's a Democrat of Oregon and chair of the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. Welcome.
Thanks, Jeremy. Appreciate it.
Well, have you gotten more information from Boeing on what the second issue actually is?
The National Transportation Safety Board is briefing my staff in Washington, D.C., but I believe we do not know exactly what the second flaw is.
Well, what do you think about the fact that we are just finding out about these flaws now after two crashes? I mean, whose fault is it that the 737 MAX was not adequately scrutinized before these crashes?
Well, look, I mean, this whole thing, it was only after the first crash of Lion Air that we learned there was an automated system that would take over control of the airplane. It wasn't even in the pilot's manual. I've seen the original manual. It wasn't there. That's the first time Boeing has ever done something like that. Airbus does it all the time. Computers fly the Airbus. Humans, pilots fly the Boeing planes. So that was an extraordinary departure from their past models. Yet the plane was marketed as being identical to a 737 and requiring no pilot training. So, you know, there's real questions about how they came to that conclusion. The fact that they allowed the system to trigger with only one sensor. Most everything on an aircraft that is safety critical requires two or three inputs before something triggers. So there are a lot of questions about the manufacturer, the disclosure, the system itself, how it works. They proposed credible fixes to it to allow the pilot to actually take the plane back over much more easily, fly the plane. But it seems that the Ethiopians followed those procedures. But since the plane was going too fast, they wouldn't work. They couldn't manually control the trim. So there are a lot of ongoing issues to be investigated here about the certification, about the disclosures by Boeing. And this is going to be a mystery that's going to take a while to totally unravel in terms of every factor and how this all happened.
Do you think people will ever feel safe flying on a Boeing 737 MAX airplane again?
Well, that's why I've asked for an independent review commission. I think this is going to be a difficult climb out of this mess for Boeing. And I think the only possible way they can do it is with an independent commission that unanimously comes to a conclusion that everything has been fixed on this plane and it's not going to happen again. It's still going to be a while to restore confidence.
Part of the issue here is also how the plane was certified. The FAA rolled out a program in 2005 that delegates some of the certification process to the plane maker. That would be Boeing. Do you think that the manufacturer should have any role in the certification process going forward?
Well, I voted against that change. I questioned the firewalls that would be set up, the fact that Boeing would be paying two different engineers, but one would be an FAA designee. It's supposedly firewalled to have an independent opinion, and then the other one would be a Boeing engineer who was working on the systems. The fact is there's so much that goes into an airplane. We couldn't hire enough inspectors to certify every little bit. But when it comes to safety critical systems, flight control systems, I think additional levels of scrutiny are very much needed.
Well, is part of the problem that the FAA is unable to attract some of these technical experts in this field because the manufacturers will pay them more to work for them?
Sure, and after the shutdown, I think we lost some more inspectors to the private sector. That's always been a problem. I think we need to look at the pay scale, the training, how these people can be more effective in monitoring the manufacturing, but you know, it started way back with Elizabeth Dole when they laid off a whole bunch of inspectors, and the inspector corps, so-called, with the FAA has never really ever recovered. So we're going to have to question a lot of assumptions that went into that this was safe and that the FAA designee was properly firewalled and trained and was able to express, open opinions and contradict the Boeing employee who also was paid by Boeing.
One more thing. You know, a lot of people are looking back now and saying, why weren't the 737 MAX planes grounded after the first crash, the Lion Air crash? Many pointing those questions to the FAA. But at that point, after that, you became the chairman of the Transportation Committee in the House. Did you think about calling for these planes to be grounded before the second crash?
No, I was on the phone with, well, first, after the first crash, I had the whole safety team in, the head of safety from Boeing. We went over what was proposed for fixes, and I think a lot of people thought that they had nailed it and, you know, the plane could fly. And then we had the second crash. No, I didn't call for an immediate grounding because we didn't have the data to know that it was similar to the Lion Air crash until it was, you know, accumulated through a system in cooperation with Canada. But I did express concern about this. I'm not, you know, not an engineer. I'm not a commercial pilot. But I told the administrator I wasn't comfortable, particularly with the way they had presented things in their statements, that everything was safe, everything was fine, and they were going to keep flying. As I said, I think I wouldn't say that, because we don't know that. Mm-hmm. I grant you that, you know, you don't want to ground them because you don't have the data showing that it was a similar recurrence, but I think that's, you know, getting out on the edge there. So it was a call on the part of the FAA and the administrator.
That is Congressman Peter DeFazio, a Democrat of Oregon and chairman of the House Transportation and Infrastructure Committee. Congressman, thanks so much for joining us.
Okay, thank you.
And Jeremy, it's the first Friday of the month, which means we got a jobs report today from the Labor Department, and this was actually a pretty good one. 196,000 new jobs added in March. Michael Regan's been following. He's senior editor at Bloomberg News. And Mike, I think the headline here really is the rebound from February. What are economists saying?
All right. Well, February was shockingly weak, and there's not really enough information to say exactly why, but there was tons of speculation and assumptions that it was maybe one part the polar vortex and one part companies getting nervous after the awful stock market drop. But it was really just that, speculation, and it wasn't really 100% clear that the labor market wasn't entering a soft patch. So this report today really confirms that it probably was an anomaly in February and that the job market remains strong. I think the New York Times put it very well, and they wrote, everyone can relax a little bit after this report.
And just to remind people, the February jobs report, 20,000 new jobs. It was revised upward to 33,000 new jobs. We also saw the unemployment rate held steady at 3.8%, a nearly 50-year low. This report showed that the average work week increased slightly from 34.4 hours a week to 34.5. But what did we learn about what people were making during that week?
Right. Wage growth came in at 3.2% year over year, and that is cooled off a little bit from 3.4% in February. But that growth in February was actually the highest in almost a decade. And the growth in wages has the pace of growth in wages has more or less doubled since the post-recession lows. And it's moved higher in sort of a two steps forward, one step back fashion. So the fact that it cooled off a little bit in the last month doesn't necessarily indicate that that trend higher is changing.
Mike, when you look at the ups and downs of this report, where the jobs were coming in and where they weren't, what are you seeing?
Well, it was pretty much good growth among all of the major sectors of the economy. One of the standouts was a rebound in construction jobs. That was a really bleak part of the February report, about 25,000 jobs lost. They regained about 16,000, so didn't quite make up for that February gain, which is somewhat disappointing. But back on track to show that the construction market is not entering a really tough spot that the February numbers might have indicated.
What about manufacturing? I saw that 6,000 factory jobs were lost last month.
Right, right. And that's kind of a surprise given you know, the big boost that President Trump has been trying to give to this sector. It's actually the first decline since the middle of 2017. So it's something I think a lot of economists are certainly going to keep an eye on. Might be somewhat related to the trade tensions, and we'll have to see if a trade deal with China sort of improves those numbers to some degree.
So on the one hand, the president today said that the numbers were very good. He's going to have to deal with the fact that some manufacturing jobs, as we just mentioned, are going away. But he also said today that he thinks the Fed should lower interest rates. And here he is. He's talking to reporters outside the White House before he gets on a plane for Calexico, California.
Well, I personally think the Fed should drop rates. I think they really slowed us down. There's no inflation. I would say in terms of quantitative tightening, it should actually now be quantitative easing.
Okay, Mike, take that last part. Why is the president saying that the U.S. government should be speeding up this bond buying program? That's what he means by quantitative easing, to juice the economy even more.
Yeah, those remarks caught pretty much everyone on Wall Street off guard. I mean, the notion of actually the Federal Reserve buying bonds and buying mortgage securities was really meant to be an emergency situation in the recession. Mm-hmm. And I don't think he'll find a lot of people that agree with him that they need to go back to that quantitative easing.
Well, and as we said, we're at 3.8% unemployment, which is very different than we were in 2008 when they did quantitative easing. Mike Regan at Bloomberg, thank you.
Thank you.
The maker of OxyContin, Purdue Pharma, is asking this week for one of thousands of lawsuits against it to be thrown out, one in Massachusetts, against the company and the family that owns it. Last month, Purdue reached a $270 million settlement in a class action suit in Oklahoma, accusing Purdue of playing a central role in the opioid crisis. This is just the latest blockbuster class action lawsuit in a country that has seen many of them over the years. And for a look back at the history, we're joined by Brian Ballow and Nathan Connolly, historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Hi to both of you.
Hey.
How you doing?
Doing well. And take us back. When did we start to see class action lawsuits in the United States?
So for those who might be less familiar, individual actions are those where you have basically one person specifically trying to bring a claim. And the class action is a really interesting 19th century development where many people with similar grievances basically joined together to file a lawsuit. And these were relatively rare as litigation in the 19th century when it was difficult to get people organized. Judges had to basically recognize people as being a class, in fact. And so you really don't get what we would believe to be or understand to be the modern class action suit until the early part of the 20th century. And there's a really important case that comes out of Boston around a giant molasses flood that occurs in January of 1919. Mm-hmm. Basically, some 40 feet of molasses barreling down the street in the north end of Boston, 2.3 million gallons, and it kills 21 people.
Well, at least we know it didn't move real quickly. Nathan.
35 miles an hour, in fact,
wow.
Brian, which
wow.
is fast for folks.
For molasses.
That's right. In January.
And you can't really move very quickly through the North End at all these days because there's so many people.
That's right.
Go ahead. Continue.
No. So the United States Industrial Alcohol Company, who was ultimately responsible for this disaster, again, 21 people killed, 150 people injured. They wound up having to pay over $600,000 in damages, which in 2019 dollars is about $9 million. And so this became what we would recognize as a corporation paying big money over protracted litigation to a large number of people. And for the most part, you know, what we have now is a combination of these kinds of large corporate actions and other actions that are built around, say, civil rights or other equality cases and such.
Well, and let's talk about civil rights. Class action lawsuits have been used in the fight for civil rights, including a key case in 1949.
Yeah, that's right. So in 1949, the NAACP tries to bring a case basically on behalf of African Americans who are being drafted into the military and who don't want to serve in segregated units or be trained in segregated fashion. So Tomlinson v. Hershey becomes a stand-in for a class action suit that the NAACP is trying to do to basically put teeth in the executive order that Truman had already signed as president to desegregate the military. And of course, the challenge to this is that you have to basically get people to show up and report for duty before you even have a leg to stand on. And so the NAACP found itself pretty flat-footed against the military brass that was very effective through the early 1950s in resisting the desegregation ruling. By contrast, of course, the NAACP is bringing another class action claim in the realm of education in 1951 that ultimately becomes Brown versus the Board of Education, which, as we know, really did represent the death knell to separate but equal accommodations as we knew it in the United States, or at least in the law.
Brian, one of the best known class action lawsuits in this country's history is the one made famous by the movie Aaron Brockovich. That would be Anderson versus Pacific Gas and Electric.
Yeah, and that's the reason to talk about it. You know, the judiciary doesn't get a lot of press. It doesn't get a lot of publicity. And frankly, people don't know that much about what goes on in courtrooms. And one of the reasons that this class action suit is so important is that Hollywood made a film about it. And the basic story is a feisty woman, played by Julia Roberts in Hollywood in the movie, convinces a lawyer that she's working with, she's a legal aide, a law clerk, to go after one of the biggest utilities in the world, Pacific Gas and Electric. And she does that because she discovers, going through real estate records, all these medical records. And what are they doing there? Well, it turns out that PG&E are buying up land because they recognized, they knew, that they had dumped a cancer-causing chemical, chromium, into the water supply, and that they had been doing that for roughly 20 years. Now, this case doesn't take place until the 1990s, but it's also a story where the little guy beats, Goliath. And it's one of the biggest settlements in the history of class action suits up to that time. It was about $330 million. The bad news, Jeremy, is that if you go to this little town in California where this is all set, it's still pretty much a ghost town, and they're still trying to get that chromium out of the water supply, or at least look at it very carefully. And that's really the story. As Nathan was saying, we think of the courts as elitist,
right?
But in fact, the courts have been instrumental in helping the little person fight back to create a kind of corporate or governmental responsibility. Mm-hmm. And we don't think of the courts in that way all that often.
Mm-hmm. Now, we are in the midst of the Me Too movement right now. We haven't seen any class action lawsuits related to that. But there have been significant class action lawsuits in the past regarding sexual harassment, right, Nathan?
There have. I mean, one of the most important cases really came through the efforts in the late 80s and early 90s to try to make the workplace a more equitable place for women. The major case in this, of course, is Jensen v. Eveleth Taconite Company, which is a Minnesota-based case that comes out around the question of mining. And you might remember the film North Country, which tries to capture some of these efforts on the parts of women to basically secure equality. Now, what's so amazing about this, Jeremy, is, of course, as Brian said, I mean, you have this long sense of the judiciary as actually being sometimes to the left of Congress or other institutions in protecting rights. And so the ability of people to even file class actions is a really important terrain for people being able to secure some benefits. And so in the 1980s, you have these women who are basically beginning to realize that they can file class action suits when they're not getting certain kinds of redress from labor unions. I mean, from the 70s through the 80s, you have women who are basically being harassed at this mine. They're suffering any manner of, you know, threats of violence and other kinds of sexual assaults. Mm-hmm. And it really becomes necessary for them to file as a group. And what's so challenging about, you know, this case in particular is just how long it took. I mean, you're talking about women who begin proceedings and complaints in the mid-80s. They're filing class action in the late 80s and don't even get a judgment until the early 1990s, right? And once that judgment comes down, it is, in fact, the first example of a class action suit on the basis of claims of sexual harassment, which then adds sexual harassment to a history around civil rights, environmentalism, and consumer protection. But the women themselves in the process had to, in many cases, relive very traumatic experiences, and in some cases felt as if it was not worth the claim to try to go through and relive that episode.
So, big picture here. Obviously, class action lawsuits in the history of this country have been an effective tool for getting things to change, but some of them do fail. And I have to think, in my own personal experience, I feel like I've gotten a few postcards in the mail that say that I'm owed 8 cents in a class action lawsuit that I didn't even know I was a part of.
Right, right. I mean, yeah, I mean, there were efforts to try to make it possible for people to basically become the beneficiaries of these suits. I mean, it's important to recognize that most people as individuals can't afford to make these claims, and they certainly can't pursue a protracted legal claim in most cases. But what did happen in the mid-60s was exactly what you're describing, Jeremy, where in some cases you have to opt out of a class action claim. You may not even know that you're part mm-hmm. of one of these suits. That was a relatively recent development in the history of class actions as they go.
One of the other things that we often miss, Jeremy, is the reaction to them within corporate America or
right.
within the government. If a large corporation pays a huge amount for let's say vermiculite mixed with asbestos for asbestos poisoning mm-hmm. Or for toxic dumping or for what happens when you smoke a cigarette. Everybody takes notice of this. So one of the reasons that we can feel safer with the products that we buy and with the water we drink is that everybody is taking note of the potential liability
right.
Of violating the regulations, violating the laws. So it's kind of a hidden form of regulation and protection. Again, it's not in our face every day, but trust me, corporate lawyers and counsels take note of every important class action decision.
Well, and they're painful for the company, even if they might not be that beneficial for the individuals, especially if there are thousands of them in a class action lawsuit.
They do have a real prophylactic impact, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's one of the things that we as consumers oftentimes have to be mindful of is that we opt out of class action rights oftentimes without even being aware of it. I mean, it really is on the front burner of lawyers' concerns. I mean, and you have terms and conditions to things that you agree to, say with Spotify or Microsoft, that then make it difficult for later class action claims to come down the road. And so exactly as has been said, I mean, there's such an atmosphere around concerns of the class action that in many cases, people are trying to take preemptive measures to make it less likely for companies to be exposed to them.
That is Nathan Connolly, and we've also been speaking with Brian Ballow. They are historians and co-hosts of the weekly podcast Backstory. Guys, thanks so much.
Thank you,
Jeremy.
President Trump called on the Federal Reserve to lower interest rates today, and he may be working behind the scenes to get what he wants. Yesterday, President Trump said he'll nominate former Republican presidential candidate Herman Cain to the Fed's governing board. Cain is the second Trump ally and central bank critic to be announced as a potential board member in recent weeks. Scott Horsley is NPR's chief economics correspondent, and he joins us now. Scott, welcome.
Good to be with you, Peter.
So some people maybe haven't heard Herman Cain's name in a while, but he was the Republican front runner in the 2012 presidential race, but then he had to drop out after he was accused of sexual harassment. Is he qualified to be on the Fed board?
Herman Cain did serve for a time as chairman of the Federal Reserve Bank in Kansas City. He got that position by virtue of his job as CEO of the Godfather's Pizza chain, not because he was steeped in the nuances of monetary policy. His short-lived 2012 presidential campaign is probably best remembered for the unorthodox 999 tax plan that
right.
he championed during that effort, and, as you mentioned, for the way the campaign ended with those allegations of infidelity and sexual harassment. Nevertheless, President Trump says he thinks Cain will pass a background check that Trump says is underway and would do very well on the board of the Federal Reserve.
Well, over the years, he has been a pretty vocal critic of the Fed. He said in a 2011 debate that the Fed should be more accountable to the public, that it should be audited, and that its focus should be narrowed. So do we have any idea if he would support the president's wish for lowering interest rates?
It's hard to say. If you look back at 2012, Herman Cain advocated a return to the gold standard, which is exactly the opposite of the lower interest rates and easy credit that the president's currently advocating. We have to assume, though, this is something that Trump and Cain have discussed. And when Trump said yesterday that he thinks Herman Cain gets it, the president presumably meant that Cain has embraced his policy positions, even though they may be at odds with those that Cain has staked out in the past.
Okay. So there's also Stephen Moore. Trump announced that he'll nominate Moore to fill another vacancy on the Fed board. Now, Moore is a former campaign advisor to the president, a conservative TV pundit. Do you think that we're seeing an attempt to politicize the Fed and to challenge the power of the chairman, Jerome Powell, who the president has clashed with recently over rate increases?
There has certainly been suggestions of that. Moore and Cain would serve on a board of seven Fed governors, so it's not clear that even with two of them, they could really affect the direction of the Fed. But they would certainly inject a more partisan flavor to what has been a pretty apolitical body. Moore, in particular, has shown considerable flexibility with his own approach to monetary policy. Mm. During the Great Recession, he wanted to see credit tightened. Now, at a time when we're adding nearly 200,000 jobs a month, Moore wants to make credit easier to come by. The only thing really consistent in his policies is they tend to favor whatever would be good for the Republican Party.
If the president moves forward and does officially nominate both of these men, they will have to be confirmed by the Senate. How does that look?
It's an interesting point because neither has been officially nominated yet, and you know, the president may be sort of floating a trial balloon,
right,
to see what happens. Since he announced that his intent to nominate Moore, some dirty laundry has come out about that nominee, although the White House says they are full speed ahead with that nomination. Thus far, no Republican senator has voiced any objection to either of these men.
All right. We'll keep watching it. Scott Horsley, NPR's chief economics correspondent, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Starting next month, a new emperor will reign in Japan. The 85-year-old Emperor Akihito is stepping down because of his age and poor health. His son, the Crown Prince Naruhito, will take his place on the throne. Akihito is the country's first emperor to abdicate in nearly 200 years, and peace has been a theme for him. Akihito often talks about World War II because he says he doesn't want people to forget that time in Japanese history. But with his abdication comes a new era for Japan, an era with a new symbolic name, Reiwa. The name is breaking with custom, and some people think it's not a good fit for Japan's future. Joining us to explain is Toshihiro Nakayama, a Japan fellow at the Wilson Center. Toshi, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
And let's start with the reason this new era was announced. It's because it's the end of an older era. The abdication of the Emperor Akihito is happening in just a few weeks. Mm-hmm. How significant is this moment in the history of what is the oldest hereditary monarchy in the world?
Well, for the Japanese people, emperor is a very symbolic existence. It shows sort of the continuity and the feeling of affinity and the fact that we are a community. But it doesn't have a political role whatsoever. So it's not it's banned by the constitution for the emperor to have any political role. So the actual sort of impact is kind of difficult to measure. But, you know, as a symbolic figure, emperor is always important. And the change of the emperor is, of course, you know, very important. And each emperor would have his own era, and each era would have its own name.
So could you explain these eras and their relationships to the emperors as they come and as they go? Why are they so important culturally to Japan?
Well, this is very unique to Japan, right? No one else uses it, even in East Asia. But it's a very important part of Japanese people's lives. For instance, when we write our birthdays in our official document, we would often use this era. Right? So like myself, I was born in Showa. That's the period before Heisei, which is right now. I was born in Showa 42. Right? So it's really important part of people's daily lives.
So you're saying that people actually still use it as a way to mark the passage of time, as a calendar system.
Exactly. It's not efficient. In some way, it's very inefficient because we kind of get confused where we are. But still, like I said, it shows you that you're part of this bigger community and you kind of know where you're at in history. So, like, Showa is from 1926 to 1989, right? It's a long period. But, like, I would call myself a Showa generation.
Right? Now, that's interesting because 1926 to 1989 spans some very historically important times in Japan, where it was very different in the 20s versus the 40s versus the late 80s.
Exactly.
How do you distinguish between that?
Well, it kind of sort of symbolizes which part of, the long span of, Japanese history. It sort of tells you where you were born and what kind of life you've experienced, right? So when I say I was born in Showa 42, clearly it was after World War II, and that was a period when Japan was surging, right? So the era of Showa sort of symbolizes a very dynamic, and at least the latter part of it has a positive connotation. But the era after Showa, which is Heisei, you know, there was a sort of a burst of economy. You know, people were talking about Japan surging, maybe even overpassing the U.S. back. It was clearly a euphoria. But back in the 1980s, we thought we were a very strong economy, maybe overconfident about it. But the economy sort of burst. So the difficult of Heisei was a very – it spans for 30 years. But it was a very difficult and stagnating era.
Now, the name of the new era, Reiwa, right. is Reiwa. Not without controversy. What is it supposed to mean, according to the government?
Well, when people speculate what kind of Chinese characters they would use, what kind of sort of pronunciation or sound it would have, and when it came out, we weren't quite sure what it was. And there were some, many speculations because these Chinese characters has various meaning to it, right? It's not like one Chinese character has one meaning. It has various meanings. And when it came out, some critical of the Abe administration, which is
Shinzo Abe, the prime minister.
Shinzo Abe, right. He's known to be a rather conservative politician, and people speculate what Prime Minister Abe's intention was. And this Chinese character, Rei, has a meaning that you order things and that it's law and order.
Well, right. It has militaristic connotations to it. What's your
reading?
Not
necessarily militaristic, but more of a order that is very structured.
Mm-hmm.
But that was not the intention of the prime minister and the people who chose this term.
So you don't think that was on purpose? I mean, was it even the prime minister's choice to make?
If it was so, it would be so silly. I think I should. We should understand prime minister's word at face value. The meaning that the prime minister and his team wanted to sort of infuse is beautiful harmony. It sort of has a sort of a calm feeling to it. And I can understand because I said Heisei was a difficult period for Japan.
Mm-hmm.
And if we look into the future, we see, China's rise. East Asia is a very difficult region, right? So we would want a calmer region. I think that was kind of the intention that Prime Minister Abe had, not just looking at what's happening, around the region, but also within. Japan would face some difficult issues. So the Prime Minister's wish wasn't to infuse his own sort of idea or anything, but to sort of portray a desirable era for the coming 10, 20 years.
The name comes from a work of ancient Japanese poetry.
That's right.
But this is very fascinating. Usually, the names of these eras come from Chinese literature.
Right.
What do you make of that statement?
Well, I mean, it's something new. As you said, we are used to choosing this term from a Chinese traditional ancient text. But this time around, it was the first time. And there were some other, candidates as well. I believe there were six altogether. And some of them were from Chinese texts. But the one that the team chose was one from the Japanese traditional text. And I can understand that, you know, Japan is in a sort of a, you know, soul-searching phase right now. You know, the economy burst. Other sort of countries in the region are rising. We have some domestic issues. So we wanted to sort of anchor, you know, our sort of feeling and how we see the future in our sort of traditional old Japanese poems. And I think that's quite natural. Some people, I understand, would see a nationalism in there, but I don't think that was the case.
You've mentioned a lot of the challenges that people in Japan are facing in the present era. There was the Fukushima disaster in 2011. Right. The economy has slowed. There's uncertainty in Asia over the future of North Korea.
Right.
The population is aging in Japan.
Right.
Do you think that this change in era will help swell the national pride?
You know, when you ask the Japanese people about this term, Reiwa, you know, 60% of the sort of the public, according to the polls, said it's good, right? But at the same time, would this Reiwa and the change of era change our daily lives and actual sort of, you know, the economy on that? More than 60% said it's not going to change. So I don't think it's going to have a direct impact on the economy or politics or the issues that we're facing. But it's a sense that, you know, this era and the times that we're living is going to be sort of, you know, on a reset mode, that and that we're going to start all over from scratch at a psychological level. So that psychological and symbolic significance is much more important than the actual. So that people don't believe that actually things is going to change.
That's Toshi Nakayama, a Japan fellow at the Wilson Center, speaking with us about the new era that is dawning on Japan, the Reiwa era. Toshi, thanks for speaking with us.
Thank you very much.
And ahead of the new era, Reiwa t-shirts, stickers, and mugs are flying off the store shelves in Japan. And in honor of the new emperor, the Grand Hyatt Tokyo is selling king-sized gourmet hamburgers 10 inches in diameter with nearly 7 pounds of beef at a cost of, wait for it, $900. According to CBS News, only one group has ordered the burger. The chef had to cut it into slices like a pie.
In Algeria today, thousands of protesters gathered in the streets of the capital, Algiers, for the seventh Friday in a row, calling for the former president, Abdelaziz Bouteflika's entire political system to be dismantled. Bouteflika resigned after 20 years in power on Tuesday following weeks of anti-government protests. Bouteflika is 82 years old, and he handpicked the interim government before he stepped down. Joining us now from Algiers is the BBC's Sally Nabil. And Sally, what's going on today where you are as this political turmoil continues?
Huge protests. I mean, thousands and thousands of protesters in the square called La Grande Fosse, which lies in central Algiers. The people here are very enthusiastic and very hopeful about the future, but they are also very determined to carry on with their demands. They say that President Bouteflika has resigned, but his regime is still in power, and that they will keep the pressure until they force the regime to leave as well. They hold the ruling elite, which includes powerful businessmen, powerful politicians. They hold them responsible for what they call is widespread corruption and repression. They want them to go as soon as possible, and they have now been emboldened by the fact that they have succeeded in unseating the president who ruled this country for 20 years, and they do have deep faith in themselves more than ever before.
And what are the plans for the election? I thought that it was just going to be 90 days from now. Is that still the plan, or do they hope that it'll happen sooner than that?
Actually, the dilemma here is that we don't know whether Algerians will take the constitutional path or the revolutionary path. According to the constitution, the current interim government should remain in power for 90 days, and the speaker of the upper house of the parliament should take over as the caretaker president. But the thing is, the people in the streets, protesters, do not accept that. They say that all these faces are part of the old regime, and they want a new phase with new faces. So the constitutional path does not seem to meet the people's demands. On the other hand, opposition figures have been putting forward some alternatives, saying that we should elect a presidential committee and a new interim government. It should include figures who are accepted among the masses. In other words, they don't want the constitutional path because they say it has failed to meet the people's ambitions. So this is the big dilemma here. The country seems to be in a state of uncertainty, and we don't know yet if they are going to carry on with what the constitutional says, or they will have another view and perhaps adopt the alternative suggested by the opposition.
Sally, if you look at the map, you see Algeria right there on the Mediterranean coast of Africa, along with Egypt, where the Arab Spring obviously played a big role, Libya, same thing, and Tunisia. Do you think that this, what's happening now in Algeria, is part of the Arab Spring just many years later?
This is what everybody says here. They say it's perhaps a new wave of the Arab Spring. And I've been talking to people just a short while ago, and they say, we hope to set a good example for all the Arab countries, in countries where the Arab Spring seems to have failed and the revolution seems to have been defeated. We need to give these people in neighboring countries a new gush of hope. And we are trying to learn from their mistakes as well, because as you may know, the army here is a key component of the political landscape. A lot of people say that anyone who wants to make it to the presidency, he has to be on good terms with the army. But the people here say we don't need a military rule anymore. We do welcome the army as a guardian, perhaps, of the transitional period. We do cherish the fact that the army sided with the people and asked President Bouteflika to abdicate power and leave. But that does not mean that we are looking forward to having a military rule. We want a civil democratic state.
And one more thing, Sally, there's obviously a sense of hope among some people there. What about fear? Are people scared of what might happen in this revolution in Algeria?
I think uncertainty creates fear because, as I said, nobody knows what's going to happen next. And I've been talking to some legal experts over the past couple of days, and they have been warning that if the protesters decide to set the constitution aside, or in other words, to freeze the constitution, this country might fall into chaos because it's very difficult for the masses to agree on one person or a group of people to lead the transitional period. And these differences might lengthen the transitional period, and it won't be only 90 days. It might drag on, and this will necessarily create chaos in the future.
That's the BBC's Sally Nabil in Algiers. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now.